Greetings. Welcome to another edition of Stardate Susitna. I'm Kathleen Fleming. This week, the waxing crescent will be pretty much absent from the skies over the Upper Susitna Valley, leaving the nights dark. If we have cloud-free nights, be prepared to notice stars, Mars, the Milky Way, and maybe some shooting stars and aurora. Stay tuned and I'll tell you more. First, the moon. New moon is on Monday. This is when the sun and moon are more or less in line, though typically La Luna is above or below El Sol. If they were truly in line, someplace on Earth would have a solar eclipse. Thing is, this week the waxing crescent moon is moving eastward along the southern part of the ecliptic, so the moon, even though it's following the sun through the sky, the moon will be setting at about the same time or even before the sun sets. Things get complicated in the far north. Thursday evening, the moon will be northeast of Jupiter. On Sunday the 14th, La Luna will be just barely above Saturn. Well, these meetups will happen very low in the south, hardly visible at 62 degrees north. Next week, the moon will be near Mars. That will be much easier to observe. More about that in next week's program. Even without the moon as a guidepost, you'll have an easy time finding Mars if your horizon is low enough. Its bright, steady, reddish light might look unnatural since it's by far the brightest object in that part of the sky. Look within 10 degrees of the southern horizon after dark until about midnight. Want to see some visual aids and learn more about this stuff? Well, come to Sioux Valley High School Monday night, 6:30 p.m. to join my basic stargazing class. I'll have extra handouts for folks who did not sign up in advance. Also, a usually dull meteor shower might give a better-than-usual show Monday night. The Draconids, or Draconids, are brief, just 3 or 4 days, with the peak of activity just a few hours long, the night of October 8th. This year, instead of the typical 5 per hour, there could be a lot more. Since the parent comet, Giacobini-Zinner, swung around the sun just last month, leaving, potentially, a lot more debris for Earth to run into. The timing of the peak is better for the East Coast, but if the sky is clear any time after dark Monday night, look up for sparks flying from the dragon's head, which is near the super bright star Vega. I'm in the process of trying to understand the claim that more aurora are seen around the equinoxes than at other times of the year. The Russell McFerrin paper, published in 1973, describes decades of data about the seasonal variations in the strength of geomagnetic storms, which typically lead to auroras, and the theories that attempt to explain the variations. Well, this is a multi-episode discussion, and this is the third Stardate Susitna to address this phenomenon. If you missed the previous two, you could catch up by listening to the archived programs online at ktna.org. Basically, the Russell McFerrin paper shows graphs based on many decades of measurements of disturbances in Earth's magnetic field, geomagnetic storms, partially caused by what's coming at us from the sun, the solar wind. Regardless of where the sun is in the sunspot cycle, there are clearly more geomagnetic storms near and shortly after the equinoxes than at other times of the year. And the paper divides the theories proposed prior to 1973 into two basic camps, the heliographic explanation and the equinoctial explanation. As mentioned in an earlier Stardate Susitna, the equinoctial explanation basically is just geometry. At the equinoxes, neither of Earth's pole is pointed toward or away from the sun, and so the middle section of the magnetosphere is pointed toward the sun and the solar wind. Is that why a crack opens up and lets more of the solar wind into the upper atmosphere? Maybe. Well, now I'll try to talk a bit about the other group of theories, the heliographic effect. Basically, the sun spins. That's been obvious since the early 1600s in the invention of telescopes. Astronomers notice sunspots and how they slide left to right across the sun's surface over the course of 2 weeks, and sometimes show up again on the left side 2 weeks later. As imagined from the north, the sun spins and all the planets revolve counterclockwise. It naturally follows that the sun has a spin axis, and if it has axial poles, then it must have an equator. Yes, yes, all that is known, easy to understand, no surprise to me. But what is new info to me is that the sun's spin axis is tipped relative to Earth's orbit. It may seem obscure and even irrelevant to you, but this just rocked my world, really threw our planet out of whack. Well, stay with me here. I'll try to explain. As far as I recall, all the info I've been exposed to as an amateur shows Earth's orbit as the reference point for all other planetary data. Earth's orbit is flat. It establishes what flat is in our solar system. All the other planets' orbits are inclined a little bit relative to Earth's orbit around the sun. The plane of our solar system is really, really very flat. The inclinations of the other planets' orbits are minimal. The whole solar system formed from a swirling cloud of gas and dust. The sun formed. The accretion disk got thinner and flatter. The planets and moons and everything else formed in this counterclockwise spinning cloud. It has always been my assumption that the flatly orbiting Earth was in line with the sun's equator. Let that sink in. Our center of gravity, the object that holds the whole solar system together, the first to coalesce from the swirling cloud, has a rotational axis, and therefore an equator, and Earth is not in line with that equator. Whoa! Ooh. Well, naturally, Earth is the observing platform for all of humankind's understanding of the cosmos. The moon and planets and the sun move through the background of stars from our earthly perspective. Of course, we judge all of their motions relative to us, Earth's flat orbit. But this Russell McFerrin paper discusses heliographic theories, considering where Earth is in our orbit relative to the sun's equator. An entirely new concept to me. Have I actually been exposed to this information and just never grasped or internalized the idea? Have I missed this fact all these years? Is this concept commonly understood by other amateur stargazers or not? Well, to answer that, I called around. I should have been taking notes so I could quote the folks I spoke to, so this is all paraphrased and reliant upon my faulty memory. First, I called Jim Egger, an infrequent contact in Palmer. Jim has built his own telescopes and has been an accomplished astrophotographer for decades. When I told him about this puzzling info, he said he had never contemplated or come across the fact that Earth's orbit is not in line with the sun's equator. It is, Jim agreed, irrelevant to how we observe the night sky. Okay, well, at least I'm not entirely alone in my ignorance. Doug and Ellen came back from a trip to Washington and told me their friend Chris, outside of Seattle, showed them some cool sights through his telescope. Saturn, always a favorite, and some double stars. I asked if they looked at Albireo in Cygnus, my favorite telescopic double. Yes, Doug said. Okay, so that told me that Chris has a good handle on stargazing and topics in astronomy. Maybe he knows about this sun's equatorial plane misaligned with Earth's orbit. So I got Chris's number, introduced myself on the phone, and a delightful conversation followed. But no, Chris was as surprised as I was by the facts that I asked him about. He was intrigued and wanted to see the Russell McFerrin paper that drew me into this inquiry. And I look forward to a follow-up conversation with Chris. Then I called Dave Parkhurst in Anchorage, a frequent reference for me, especially when it comes to aurora. Dave has been photographing the Northern Lights for over 30 years and has made a business with his awesome photos, one of which is posted with last week's program online. I think it was Dave that was indeed familiar with the fact of Earth's orbit not being in line with the sun's equator, but he did not necessarily connect that with seasonal variations in the aurora. In fact, Dave, with his 3 decades of experience, has not noticed a distinct seasonal difference in the number or intensity or color of auroras. He has had deep discussions with professionals around the country, folks who develop forecasts for geomagnetic storms and the resulting probability of northern and southern lights. Dave has told them about numerous occasions after a night with a high KP or AP index, after he'd been out all night long watching and waiting with camera and tripod and cold fingers, nothing noteworthy happened. No distinct lights. Well, it's a mystery. Dave pays attention to the aurora forecast and the B sub Z number, hoping it's a negative, but he does not rely on those. If the sky is clear and dark, he's out. So the frequency and intensity of geomagnetic storms may indeed be greater at or after the equinoxes, but they don't necessarily result in more or brighter or more colorful auroras. I don't photograph or keep records of aurora. Perhaps you have, and maybe you have comments to share about their seasonality. I'd love to hear about your experiences. Contact me through KTNA 733-1700. Thanks. And next week, I'll try to explain, as far as I understand, why Earth's crossing the sun's equator creates an increase in geomagnetic storms during October. And one of those strong probability of aurora forecast is on hand right now. Sunday, good. Monday, even higher. Now let's hope for clear skies Monday night for Northern Lights, Draconid Meteors, and going out behind Sioux Valley High School with my stargazing class. More next week. Until then, keep looking up.
You've been listening to Susitna Writer's Voice, a production of Talkeetna Community Radio. You can hear these recordings anytime at ktna.org. New contributors are always welcome. You may call the station at 733-1700 for more information.